This is Channel 2 Over and the beginning of the visit with Jane Miles, Suzanne, Rick, and Faye. This Friday, the 21st of July, 72. Channel 2 Over, and the beginning of the visit with Rick and Jane Miles, and Suzanne. This Friday, the 21st of July, 72. Channel 2 Over, and the beginning of the visit at lunch. Friday, the 21st of July, 72.
Buttering when he talks. I think he has a lisp or an impediment of some kind. Mm-hmm. Listen very carefully, and sometimes the notation is a little too strong. And I would detect like a little mispronunciation that he couldn't control, but had worked on enough to where most people would notice it.
All I ever heard about Dr. New was the, you know, the stories that went around about him in the library. And he just gossip was all it was, I guess.
What about him in the library?
Not much. Supposedly he would go up in the stacks and watch girls.
I believe that.
Sort of follow them around and keep his eye on them, you know, and just watch them. And several people in the library had to speak to him about it. And finally, they asked somebody in the English department, I guess the chairman. I know it wasn't Morris, but somebody would go speak to Dr. Moon and, you know, ask him not to do that. Well, in the college library, you see, it's dark, and they have a stack back there. Supposedly, now, he wasn't, they never said this about him, but, you know, guys would go in there, and they'd stand on a lower level and look at the upper level.
Oh.
It's supposed to be kind of, the librarians, the girls would not go back in the stacks after 5.
Yeah.
They wouldn't go back in there even at night.
that risk you're in. But you were talking about the gospel.
The gospel according to New?
Yeah, but you've got my gospel. Give us his.
Well, he created the world in 7 days, I think, and laid out a master plan how he's going to run it, and he sits up on top of the mountain running it.
That's your
opinion. His opinion.
You mean you just drink and then quit?
Yeah. But he's the most insensitive man I ever met in my life. He walks around with his head in a paper bag, he must. Because we have a class in the library, my seminar's in the library, and it's a little room, you know, this round table. And he sits there, and there are no windows, and it's air conditioned. And he smokes these great big Havana cigars.
Uh-oh.
And there are 14 of us and him. 14 of the people in that room are sitting around coughing and hacking and dying with tears running down their faces. We're having to read papers aloud. None of us can talk because of the smoke and the smell. It was just incredible. And here's a silly little man sitting at the front of his table smoking this cigar, and he's completely oblivious to the fact that we're all going to pass out because of the smell. And he does this for 2 hours, twice a week. Finally, someone said, you know, Dr. New, about that cigar. And he said, oh, yeah, it was a $1.15 cigar that I got that's from imported from Siam or something and hand chewed by a goat or some fancy dancy kind of cigar. I don't know what it was. But and they were, you know, wanting to say, Doctor knew about that cigar, could you put it out? And he just said, oh yeah, and told us the price and still smoked them. Incredible. One girl brought incense the other day, started burning incense down at the other end of the table. Put it in a little piece of tinfoil on the floor. He let us out 25 minutes early.
That mixed with it. It mixed.
With a cigar. That's terrible. But he's just, he has his ideas and he's right. And well, you know, we have to read Matthew the Pope, and that's what we read all the time. And so this, we have to present 5 papers to the seminar, and you read the papers, and the seminar asks you about them. And so this one girl read a paper yesterday, and she said something about Defoe's wordy, verbose style, or his loose, verbose style. So the minute she got done, you know, she put the paper down, and he said, now about that loose verbose style, you know, before she ran out of time to get her breath. And she said, yeah, well, I think he's pretty wordy. And so he went off into this commentary about how he thought that Daniel Defoe had a very tight, compact, organized style, and he was one of the, he had beautiful. He says, maybe that's what you're talking about, beautiful, beautiful prose style and prose writing. He was one of the first beautiful prose writers.
Yeah.
And his style is horrible, because he writes these 12-line sentences, and he starts off with the weather and winds up with his great-aunt Matilda, who sprained her toe, and he covers everything in between it, and it's just all full of all kinds of nonsense, and he's trying to explain to us that that was a compact, organized sentence. And that's the biggest bunch of garbage I ever heard in my life.
What was that in?
In Defoe. In his Journal of the Plague here. She said that was just a Defoe, a Defoe trademark. It's his rambly sentences that sort of cover everything.
Yeah.
And he's up there trying to make a case for them being compact. And we're all 14 of us saying, no, they're not compact. He just sprawls all over the place. And he said that when he lectures, he uses Defoe as an example of an organized style. We're just shaking our heads. No, that's not right. He doesn't have an organized style. He just remember what he started with when he finishes the sentence.
Well, does Defoe get in control of it later?
Not really. He hasn't yet. Maybe by the time he finishes writing. I haven't read his later books. We're reading them, you know, pretty much in the order they were written.
Yeah.
Maybe by the end of his writing he did, but the first four he sure hasn't.
Gee whiz, you'll be one of the special elect.
That's just what you're reading?
Defoe, yeah. According to
five things that you've actually read before.
Well, I will have read 10 by the time I'm done with the course. Most people get off with Robinson Crusoe, and I had to read a whole 10.
New used to make comments about, he would kind of smile and talk about his graduate students with bleary eyes because they're reading so much.
Yeah, I would believe that.
And an undergraduate, we were pushing 500 or 600 pages a week. And when you've got 3 or 4 other courses,
It's a lot of pages, yeah.
And all the little weekly quizzes?
We didn't have quizzes, we just had pages. We had weekly pages.
He would give us a little weekly quiz, which amounted to asking in so many words, have you read the book?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I'd be behind. And I'd get back, he says, you got behind on Joseph Andrews, now you're behind on this. He had it plotted out, he knew just where you, just almost a page that you'd stop reading.
Oh, really?
He's an incredible man. He's amazing. But you can't tell him anything, though, because he knows. And he has his biases, and he was asking us why we were having a hard time understanding 18th century Puritanism. Well, because we weren't living in the 18th century, and none of us are Puritans, you know. And he said, well, haven't you all had some course, this course? And you know. He said, you must have taken that modern garbage. That's all you do. You take that modern garbage. And whenever he needs an example of a bad piece of writing, you know, he wants to compare someone to Defoe who was a good writer, and he'll pick on Ernest Hemingway, who he doesn't like at all. And he says, of course we have Hemingway, who doesn't know his ass from a hole in the ground, and he'll go on about that for half an hour. And then he comes back and tries to tell us that Defoe does, and I don't know how he can do it with a straight face. I couldn't sit there and try to convince somebody that Defoe knows how to write.
Does he go into Hemingway? Or just...
No, he just uses him as a bad example.
Yeah.
So if you need an example of bad this or bad that, we always have old Ernest there. He doesn't know what he's doing.
Yeah.
But the reason we have this whole course in Defoe, and everybody that I've talked to, even people in the department, don't think we need a whole course in just Defoe. The reason we do it is, according to Melvin, whose master plan for taking over the world, in the graduate school, there's a course that he teaches that nobody wanted to take because he teaches it and everybody hates the course because he teaches it. So the department said, all right, well, we'll have another course that can be substituted for the first one that he teaches. So he said, okay, let's have another course. I'll teach that too. So he teaches both courses that are substitutable for each other. So no matter how you look at it, you can't get out of graduate school unless you have at least one course under him. And he was the new course that he's starting is the making of a novel or coming of a novel or from whence the novel came or something. And he figures that in order to figure out how the novel came about, you start at the beginning, and Defoe was one of the first novelists. So we're the guinea pigs for his fall graduate course. And that's the whole purpose of this stupid course I'm taking. And all I have learned that is that I really don't care for Defoe, and I don't care for Dr. New either, and that's about all I've gotten out of the
course. Well, that regular 18th century course he teaches, have you had that?
Mm-mm.
You had that?
I was in there I was in there about 2 days, and I could see why a lot of students like him. They think he's a fine teacher. They hard, you know, and he's pretty particular about his grading, but you can pick up just worlds and worlds and worlds of information because
mm-hmm.
he knows what he's talking about. And he started out on Samuel Johnson, and just he made the reading assignment, and I read it, and he didn't give a quiz to him, but anyway, it was that just straightforward information. He had hold of it. He could talk, you know, and it came easy. It wasn't any sort of. It's very business like.
Mm-hmm.
He just walked in.
The seminar where the students teach it, you don't get that.
No.
I think that's one of the worst things about that type of seminar where you have all those student reports. The professor almost sits back and washes his hands.
Yeah. That's the only time that he really stuck his 3 cents in was when he wanted to complain to that one girl for saying that she thought that Defoe was too wordy. That's the only time this whole quarter he's actually interjected his own theories about it.
You got stuck. You need the 18th century.
Mm. Well, this thing mm. substitutes for that, so I didn't have to take it.
I mean, you got the wrong side of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, because when I had him in the 18th century, as soon as the hour started, he was lecturing. And if class wasn't there, that didn't matter. He was lecturing. And it was all planned out. He'd make his statement, and he'd follow through with all the evidence he needed from the book. And then he would ask questions. He had 10 minutes every day or so to ask questions, and he'd get a lot of response from the class. And they would drift off the topic in the 18th century literature and go into contemporary questions. And I remember it got to be a little contest in the class where we kept pushing it out of the subject. So we'd just ask him any question we want. We'd give him long, involved questions on art or drugs or something and make him think on his feet. He could do it. He would just stand there and think and think. And if he couldn't come up with an answer, he'd start to develop like a thesis, and then he'd say, but let me think about this, and I'll tell you tomorrow. And the next day when he came in, before he'd start his lecture, he'd go, about the question yesterday, and then he would let go with his answer. And it was a solid one.
Oh, he's an organized man. He's very thorough, you know. But he's just terribly irritating. And if he has thought something through and decided some sort of thing, there's no swaying him. And so he spends a good part of this our class time justifying the fact that he's making us read a whole quarter of the book. And I think he's kind of sorry he did it that way instead of having us read selected novels or something of that period, because he's really having trouble because people still say, you know, well, how are you all doing? And we're all kind of frown and groan, you know. And he'll say, well, how did you like Captain Singleton? Well, you've read one, you've read them all, you know. So I feel like you're reading one long continuation of Robinson Crusoe. And he'll go off into some commentary on, well, why we have to read all of these to show his progress. But he never could make a really good case for him having made any progress.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the papers, you know, people will say, well, we all know that Defoe gets very boring and tedious, but they start off papers like that. And they'll say, and this one girl yesterday read a paper on how she thought that Journal of the Plague Year was the furthest along of his books, but still hadn't really gotten anywhere. You know, she said something to the effect of, Defoe can make progress without gaining any ground. and And she said that she felt the progress in this one particular book was that it was only 240 pages long, whereas the rest were all in the 400s. So he managed to cut out a lot of his excess paraphernalia that he throws in, which is a sign of progress. But even in the 240 pages that he had, he didn't say anything. That upset Dr. Mill a bit.
It always tickled me when he came in class one day and was talking about, I guess it was love. And Nu was this very definite kind of person, like you say, he had his way. And he said, when I met my wife, I knew in 2 weeks, I knew that was the one. He went out and married her right away. The only thing that ever stopped him was we had a bird fly in the window one day. And you know those windows in Anderson are about 3 feet from the ceiling. Well, the bird got up around the top, around the light, and wouldn't come down to the window. Every time he would start the lecture, the bird would fly, and he'd run into the walls and flap his wings, and then he'd sit on the lights and chirp a little bit. So he'd say, Dr. New, maybe if we turned out all the lights, and the lights in the window would attract. He said, all right, so he turned out the lights. He's lecturing in the dark. The bird took off and flew into the ceiling again. So Dr. New would pull all the windows shut at the bottom and open the top. So he's over there, but he can't reach the windows. He's too short. So we had to get all the students up to go pull the windows down on top. New goes back to lecture. Bird wouldn't leave. Bird kept flying around. And New finally looks up at the bird and says, well, I think what we'll do is just continue the lecture tomorrow. So we all just walked on out. About the time we all got out of the class, New's down the hall, and I look back, and bird out the window. I didn't say a word.
Well, we have people who have the seminar room next to me have some kind of seminar in black culture or black politics, and there are a lot of black people and there are a lot of white people. And so they get in there and they're relating to each other and they're jumping around and making a lot of racket. So in this one paper, he's up there giving his 5 or 10 minute spiel on Providence, and all of a sudden we hear this, yay! From next door. And he says, well, it must be the hand of God, you know, coming down and agreeing with me or something. And they're carrying on, and he walks next door. And he says, you have to keep this down. And he walks back, and they go, yay! And he just said, well, you know, there was a teacher in there back in the corner someplace. And he says, no, I just don't understand why someone would let people make all that noise. He said, now, of course, if any of you have any frustrations, feel free to take off your clothes and run around naked. That's the way he reacts to everything, you know, because a lot of people now are getting really interested in the concept of letting students, you know, do what they want and say what they want and all. But he just thinks this is ridiculous, and he mocks everything, you know, that they do. And whenever we do show any kind of enthusiasm, and I think the only enthusiasm we've really shown was when one girl said, I think I'll make brownies for next week. Because if we have this 2-hour class, and I get hungry, because I have the class from 3:30 to 5:30, and about 4 o'clock, I'm hungry. So we all sit around, and our stomachs growl, and he lectures, and we all pine away for the crystal across the street, and there we are, stuck. So the one girl said, well, I'll bring brownies and see how that is. And so we all are, hooray! You know, this is some of the class next door. So, but we brought brownies anyway. Pass them around.
This business, she gets into some other things. I think she's going to be like you, Suzanne. Things will fall in her lap. This business of, I was going to, Rick brought your letter in, you see, and I read it, and I was going to let him read it, but I forgot it. It's lying in there on the, by the typewriter. About the education business.
Oh, well, what it is this quarter I have 3 English courses. That's all I'm taking. And I have history and language, which is linguistics, but it's interesting. I had never had any course like that before, so I like it. It's because it's new to me, you know. And I have Dr. New, and I have great books of the ancient world. And in that, we had to read the Iliad the first week, and the Odyssey the second week, and the Aeneid the third week, and 6 plays by Sophocles the fourth week, And I'm not learning anything in there. All I'm doing is skimming a lot of material, but I don't remember any of it. And I have Dr. New and I have Dr. Murphy, and those two are supposed to be, you know, fairly intelligent people in the department. They're supposed to know what they're doing. And it dawned on me, my God, neither of those people have any idea what goes on in the world. Because Melvin, he's as far removed from people as anybody I've ever met in my life. And Dr. Murphy's got to have rocks in his head if he thinks that we can cover that much material. You know, he just must not have any conception of it. And he's so removed from what he's doing that the notes he lectures from are about this color, whereas they were at one time white, and they're all taped, and they're all frayed out and raveled. And
if you ask him a question, he says, well, I haven't read that this course yet.
Yeah, I haven't covered that recently. One girl asked him why somebody or other's translation of the Iliad that we read was covered one passage much differently than Alexander Pope did when he translated it. She said, you know, why would Pope see this one way and this translator see it the other? Because they put a completely different tone to it and made it appear completely different just in the translating. And he said, well, you know, I haven't read Pope in so long, I really don't remember. And he's just really out of touch with what he does. And I don't think he's read the Iliad probably in 30 years. He just has good notes on it, you know. And he's just so out of touch. And I thought, well, my God, if I stay in English, you know, I might be all demented like that one day, you know. And I don't want to do it. And so I was walking around talking to a friend of mine who's a graduate student. And he's working on his PhD in medieval poetry. And he said to me, and I was thinking, you know, well, maybe I shouldn't be in English. So anyway, he came over one day and he said to me, you know, I've been thinking, maybe I shouldn't be in English. And I said, why is that? And he said, well, I've been working under this guy and working in conjunction with that guy. And I don't know what they're doing. And if I go through and get my PhD, I might be like that too, and I don't want to do it.
And he was doing what?
And he's working on his PhD. And
in medieval
poetry, alliterative poetry. And so he has a bunch of friends who are in education counseling, and I had met several of them with him, you know, different times. And he said, you know, I think I'll go over and talk to people over there, see what they have to say. So he went over and talked to this one guy, and he said to me, yeah, you should go talk to him. He's very interesting. If nothing else, it's worth, you know, 10 minutes of your time to go meet him, because he's a real nice man. And so I did. I went over.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, I went over and I met him. I talked to him for an hour and a half. He's one of the nicest people I ever met. He's a real, you know, a real alive person. He's very alive. And I thought, oh my God, after all the old fossils, because after you, I think he's a fossil. He may be in his 30s or 40s or something, but I think he's a fossil. But this man, you know, he was just so full of ideas and so alive, and he has on a flowered shirt, and he's walking around, he has posters in his office, and he's just all full of all kinds of ideas and energy, and he's got books on art and a program from a play and different things that he's involved in, you know, he's in counseling. And so I talked to him for a while, and he said to me that I should see about going into counseling maybe, because people who often come from English or come from the arts tend to be fairly sensitive, you know, because of, yeah, of what they're dealing with, so they would be apt to do well. And he said also that it was good I hadn't had any education courses, because that would, I would be therefore unspoiled, you know, education courses being what they are. And so I thought, yeah, and I thought anybody who's in education counseling, the Department of Education, you know, has to be pretty noble to come out with that. So I just really had a good talk with him, you know. He's really an interesting person. So I went home and thought about it and pondered on it and put in my application to graduate school there. The special program, counseling education. So what it is, they have the 2-year program, and you get a master's in education and a counseling specialist degree simultaneously. And the program is set up so you have about 4 quarters of coursework and 2 quarters of practicum, and you do things and you write reports on it every week or so and send them in, telling them what you've learned from it or what you've gained from it or how you think it's useful or not useful or fruitful or not fruitful or a pain in the ass or whatever you think it is, you know. And you work at the counseling center at Little, or you run an encounter group, or you work with Head Start, or you work with Samson, or you do something, whatever your particular interest is. And so I thought
that would just sew you out, wouldn't it?
So I thought if I did that, I could.
She gonna be writing on alliterated poetry.
I don't want to do it. I would rather be in touch with people, because
she'd rather be a follow.
Well, I thought about it, and I thought I just don't need to do that, and I would rather be in touch with people and doing something, and have a chance to be alive instead of sitting around reading poetry that was written 6 million years ago that nobody's interested in anyway, because if the poetry and the books and things I can still read on my own, and still get things out of them. I can go to lectures and I know people I can talk to them about, but I wouldn't want to spend my whole life doing that. No. I wouldn't want to do that every day.
Just make a book, read a book, write a book.
Yeah, I don't want to do that. I want to.
Make a book to ourselves, others, yeah.
I don't want to spend my time editing.
I didn't know there were such people alive.
I didn't either. He's an amazing man. He's just all kinds of people with an individual.
Somebody was talking to an education man. And he said, there's no certainty. You just get something fruitful. That's my terminology. And I've forgotten his, you see. They said that. And he said, where'd you find that? Well, he says, one of my professors said that. Well, he says, you sure are lucky. And it's all about me, but it, you know, in connection, you see, I've worked with you all so much, I don't know whether it's me or you. Well, anyhow, I should have gone and seen him right then, but I am so slow. I'm not a fossil, I'm a stick in the mud. I just can't move, you see, I just can't make it. You see, Suzanne threw me off this morning. I'm doing fine till breakfast. Now you see, she got me in that damn little old horse she's got. Tell me about that darn little horse, Suzanne.
When I left up Georgia, Bubba was in this state of hysteria.
I just have to get up and stretch every now and then. My boy is still.
Yeah. We took him up there, and this fellow across the road had two horses in our pasture. So Bo got out and made his acquaintance, and they squealed. And, they wouldn't let him close to him. There had to be a respectable distance between these two horses that were already on the premises and Bubba, who was the newcomer. And the little pony, there was a mare and the pony wouldn't let Bubba close. So they'd go up and get a drink of water, and Bubba would wait till they finished and all. He'd go up and he'd get his drink of water. They wouldn't let him close, and we tried to ride him one night. And the two horses were back in the back. We brought Bubba up and fed him and started trying to work with him, and he just couldn't get his attention. He wanted to get back with the other two horses. And he danced around, he kept going around the end of the street. You know, he tried to get him to stand still so we could put the saddle on him, and he'd start filing around and moving back and forth and jumping up. We finally rode him because we knew we had to ride him. You know. We rode him about 5 minutes, and the whole time he was like, woo! He just shake. And he couldn't even get him to look at you. He wanted off. So the next day, the horses left. Ronnie took him across the road and put him in his corral. And they were just out above his sight. He couldn't see him. So for about 3 days, about a day and a half, he ran up and down the call. No answer, no sight of horse. So he calmed down. And he started, I think he kind of liked being by himself in a way, because he just had the run of his place. Anytime we were doing anything, he'd come up and visit with us and stick his nose in it and pick up sacks of nails and shoot a hole in the tar paper they put across the floor, just reached down and grabbed it and ripped it off. And and we were doing fine. We could ride him, we could feed him, we could play with him, we could do anything. And he's calm and cooperative. And then Daryl left the two horses out of the corral into the pasture, and he could see them. That ended things. He just crazy. He was down by the creek and he heard him. They galloped out of the corral once they were loose, and he heard him and he tore up the hill and he looked over the fence and he saw those two horses out there, and that just, he started running up and down, back and forth, you know. He'd run to one end of the pasture and he'd call him. He'd run to the other end of the pasture and he'd call again, and back and forth, and he'd take a little detour so he'd build up speed. And went on all afternoon and tried to feed him, brought him down, and he started eating. And I got the sweat scraping, wiping off. I was going to try to walk him around to cool him off because there was rain coming. And I thought, well, with the wind and the rain, he'll catch cold. You know, because it's so hot.
Yeah.
And it worried me. So I wiped, scraped off all the lather and sweat, and I was going to leave him around. My sister-in-law, she's 16, she's never been around horses. She was holding the rope. And I thought, well, there's no need to tie it. I'll just let her hold it for a minute. And he wasn't finished his food, and he always stands there and licks out, you know, the tiniest grains there in the corner. You know, he just stands there for 30 minutes trying to get out of his teeth. And all of a sudden, he just took off. I said, hold on to him. He spurts, threw the rope up in the air, and there went my horse, you know, with the rope down between his legs, and he just galloped off back to the fence. No hesitation whatsoever. And I went up there, and I caught him. He stopped, and I caught him, and I was going to take him back and walk him around, you know, make him walk and cool off. And he wasn't having any doubt that. He started trotting, you know, tight little circles around him. Faster and faster, and he'd stop and he'd nicker and call to the other two horses, and he'd start trotting again around and around. So I finally just let him go. He wasn't gonna walk. And we didn't ride him that night. We didn't ride him for the next 2 nights. Maybe 3 days. When I
got that halter rope on him?
No, it took the halter rope off. But for 3 days, it was just constant. You know, you could hear him off. No matter where you were, you could hear him move from one end of the fence that goes up along the road to the other. You could just hear him move back and forth, trying to keep the other two horses in sight. And he'd come down to get a drink of water down the little stream there, and he'd race up just as fast as he'd come and slam on the brakes, you know, and slide to a stop. He'd get his drink of water. And then he'd whirl around and he'd race off again back to the fence. You know, before he started, he nickered kind of in blow. It sort of called him, and then he'd snort and take off. It went on all night. So you hear him, you know, he woke up, you could hear bubble up there in the back. Down at the camp, we'd be eating, we could see him running back and forth along the fence, you know, or trot, just standing up there. And all night. In the morning, he wouldn't eat his food. And Bubba has never left his trough with anything in it.
Yeah.
Never. I have never seen him leave with anything in the food trough.
And you talk about feeding. I didn't realize what they fed. This little Helen Phillips out here, she's such a beautiful thing. And I just hate to see him take her off. And Laura, the little girl, had come out here to feed. And stick around a little while, but you got to see to it that the filly eats your feed. Well, I went out there, the filly was gone, I looked in there, and good Lord, there's more feed left in there than I'd feed a cow. And Suzanne said, that's the way they fed Bubba.
We feed him 5 quarts. Let's see, we feed him 10 quarts a day. We feed him 4 in the morning, and 4 at night, and 2 in the middle of the day. Because he's up there, and we put bug stuff on him, keep the flies off him, so we just give him 2 quarts of feed. 10 quarts a day. And he never, have I ever in the stable here or any place seen him leave food. And I went out
cleans
there one morning, cleans it out, and then licks on the wood for half an hour. Then he comes back during the day and sees if there's anything in it.
Well, now you see, Ajax, he was a spirit. He'd eat a little food, but he'd look at you, talk to you more than he'd eat. Now this little horse will do the same thing. She's not innocent, of course.
She sits up there and she looks around, talks.
She won't even stay there if you don't stay with her.
Yeah.
We have to put a board in behind her to keep her in.
She wants to be with the other horses. They don't like being on the same.
He must see you. But God, he's
at the stable where we had him, we never had that problem. The other horses would be out in the pasture, and we'd whistle him to come up, and he'd come up, and we'd trot as soon as he came, and we'd feed him, and work with him, and ride him, and there's no trouble at all. He wouldn't go in this stable. But now, Lord help us, he'd been in those horses a day and a half, and we took him away from him to ride him. They were somewhere back there. And I never seen him like that. He just went crazy to me. He thought it was mine.
Well, I see. You've got to make a statement in order to. She rambles, you see. I mean, she's got something in her mind, but it never quite, you know, she leaves it.
Well, I guess it was this morning. The thing was,
I didn't run her down, you know.
Jim and I knew how. Daryl asked her, he says, "You want me to put the horses back up, back in the corral, so Jim Bubba couldn't see them?" And I thought a little bit, and I said, "No," I said, "Bubba's got to learn that, you know, he's by himself, or else if he doesn't learn, we're just going to have to make him. You know, just get on him and ride him and make him pay attention." Jim and I are the last people in the world to make Bubba pay attention to us. And it got to be just, I think, the first day I worried about him, and I felt sorry for him, but there he was, so lonely. And then I got to thinking, that horse knows we don't want to ride him when he's like that. And I didn't, I just turned him loose. I told him, I said, "Well, I feel a little sorry for him, but not much."
You know, all you got to do is speak to him. You can speak to him, mm-hmm. and the tone of voice will calm him down. And he'll stand there. If you speak to him. All it takes is just a voice. You don't even have to hit him with a tube for it. Ain't that kind? Well, you gotta have a horse with a broken one to speak. And he'll forget those horses to speak to him. Now Newby won't. She's hard headed. Missy will. All you gotta do is speak to her.
Yeah, she did last night.
I didn't realize a horse was like that. You see, I'd holler at a horse like it were a cow. You don't have to holler at a cow. I just brought up and hollered at him. This little help from Philly was chasing a little heifer. Not bad, just a little bit. Sometimes the heifers like to be chased. It was sort of fun. But she wasn't afraid because I spoke to the Philly. She quit right as soon as I spoke to her. And all the heifer did was just turn around and look at her. And just stand there and chew. So, you know, it was an hard feeling. Just the voice. Just the voice, bro. Now, did you ever see anybody just like Waves My Horse? He's the only one I ever saw. Now you see, he's done all that by himself. Well, he read Emerson with me a long time ago. But see, when he read Emerson with me, I didn't know some of the things that I know now. Nothing that have anything to do with that, with the quoting he does. But I tell you, part of that, he lived over here for 2 or 3 years in a trailer, and at that time, he could talk, but when he came up here, he'd start talking a little bit, about some of these architects and other scoundrels that he worked with who wasn't paying. But then he'd quit and throw it to me. I didn't have anything to say. I was waiting to hear about the architects and all. But he went right, and I thought his mind was falling apart. But see, I ran him off over here. He went over there and made an opening. And he's just in his element. And I think part of it is, that's what we better, you see, that's what we said in the race. Over there, he doesn't have to make a trip across the county halfway to for exposure. He just step out on the street,
mm-hmm.
like we said. And that is. And here last time, I give anything if you could have heard that one little section. He went down to type, and that's old Jack Sanders. He's a redneck, he called him. And he had his friends out there, old Jack Herring and somebody else. And they were going to play odd man out to see who bought the beer. And that was the end of it. Didn't get the kite. But the whole thing went on. This spontaneous. He came over here to talk about something else. That strategy for the town meeting is what he came to talk about. Mm-hmm. And what you had was they talked about it and then they acted it out. I mean, he saw some of it. They all drank these beers and they got to talking. And old Tom Preston.
Bill
Preston.
He and
Jack Herring went to school together. Good friend. Well, old Jack Herring, you see, just falling apart. And I guess he always been falling apart. And Bill Preston got his arm and hammer. He's professional. He said to, now they reported this, Suzanne could tell you better than I can, I never get anything straight, but when I listen to it, I'm so overwhelmed, I don't remember. He got put out with Jack, and he said he just couldn't hit him, he said it's against the law. He says he wished he was not a professional, so he could just knock the tar out of old Jack. Well, somehow or other, Jack got over there, and car, and he pulled him out of the car and knocked the tar out of it. And here he kicked. Well, it was complicated. It's not complicated, it was simple. But they were sitting on that bench in front of Weaver's store. Weaver's store is closed now. And here came old Bill Preston.
Yeah, Jack was sitting there on the store.
And Jack's wife is one eye. And Wade make a whole lot of that eye, that one eye. And I told him he couldn't perform it, you see. He had to be, you know, he couldn't be condescending. And she said, Jack says, go get him. Jack got up, walked out in the middle of the street. Bill Preston was walking along. Started to roll up his sleeves or something or other.
Yeah, are you ready now?
Yeah, are you ready now? And Bill Preston wouldn't stop. He wouldn't even look at him. He just walked on. And the idea of it was, you see, the direction of it was perfectly clear. It's perfectly clear. It was beautifully done. That they love to fight. They just love to fight. Now, he said it once, sort of accidentally, but he didn't need to say it. It was all there.
Yeah. Even Jack's wife.
Yeah, that was it.
She told him, now's your chance, Jack, get out there. And Jack wouldn't go, so she called out to Bill and said, I'm going to go beat up your wife.
Yeah.
Yeah. And old Jack and his wife scrap all the time.
Just bloody. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's what came up. You never saw anything like that? Well, you see, he can do the other two. I mean, he reads.
They all live up in trees someplace. They live up in towers, and they don't come in contact with anybody.
Well, why can't they do a little of this, too?
I don't think they're very interested in it. I think they all think they're so smart they know everything, and they don't have any need to get down and talk to people. I've only had two teachers in the whole school, and I could honestly say thought that they might possibly not know everything. There might possibly be something they can learn from a student.
Oh, really?
And I've had a bunch of them. I've had all kinds of notes that live that way.
Yeah.
But most of them figure by the time that they're 6,000 years old and have 14 PhDs and have edited 90 books, they all feel like they know everything, and they have really no need to talk to some dumb, piddling 20-year-old kid that doesn't know what they're doing.
Well, I tell you, my view of it is a little different. They could do it if they would, but they have found out. You see the bureaucracy is rich now.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like that fellow, the dean's notes. What is that? Dean's notes. Dean's letter that he gets out. It's going to call everybody in there who has been somewhere to a professional meeting and read the paper. And that's all you got to do to get in it. And tell them about it so they can put you in. And you know, something had happened that day that made it. I have to be pinched before I think, you see. And I had one of those in my hand, and I was looking at it. And it just came to me. As the role simply could not afford to go see the groundhogs, they'd all get on to him. His mama and his friends and everybody, and they'd say to him, "You can't afford to go to that old groundhog. You've got to do like these other fellas. Go to them meetings. You don't want to starve us, do you?" It's so rich.
Mm-hmm.
There's no money in collecting groundhogs.
Now they're having such a big fucking production of who's going to be tenured and who's not. They told this one man who's my counselor that I'm pretty fond of him. I know him pretty well.
Yeah.
I talked to him a lot in his office yesterday. I had a 4 o'clock appointment to be counseled. I got home a 7:15. But they informed him that if he didn't publish something in 12 months, he was going to be looking for a new job. And that's a terrible thing, because he does, I think he teaches very well. He's one of very few people who is interested in talking to his students.
Well, now, what did Wade talk about the day you were here?
Fish getting together. The man who gets together fish fries and barbecues and
yeah.
Swimming parties and things like that. I don't remember his name.
Jack Sanders.
Yeah.
I don't know.
And also the garbage man.
Oh, he talked about McQuinney a little.
Yeah. And all the tools and things he has.
Yeah. Just phenomenal. You never expect it. Rick, let me tell you, before you, of course, something happens. It happened in the middle of the start even. I want to left off last night?
We were on the ties in that.
Yes, those ties. Yes, the bag boys, you see, won't wear ties. But this time...
Yeah. See, they wanted us to wear a little black bow tie and a white shirt. But that went out a long time ago. So we went to a long tie.
You're being followed.
And what they do is they get a little clip-on tie. Because that way, when they could get off the front and didn't have to bag groceries, they go in the back and they let go of the tie and it'd fall off.
You know,
and unbutton their shirt.
You know, I didn't know this. I just somehow or other, in my mind, those bag boys all wore little clip-on bow ties. But it's not so.
No. The only ones that I can remember wearing bow ties were guys that were like 45, 50 years old, and they were still bag boys. And that was all they were ever going to be, a bag boy. And then with these clip-on ties, see, if you get called up front, you just look it back. And away you go. And after 9 o'clock, when the store closes, the ties are off. They had loosened them and pulled them down.
On the way.
Yes. Yes. And they went on break. They loosened their ties. And you could always tell if somebody was on break because the tie would be down. And you knew not to ask him to do anything. He could walk around the store for 15 minutes, but you knew, don't tell him to do anything because his tie was down.
That's some of the finer points.
Do they still have to wear?
Oh, yeah. Now, they get away with a lot more than they used to. They don't wear them in the meat department at all. But, see, they wear those big white coats, and they button them up. Sometimes they'll come to work dressed, old, nice dark red shirt and a white tie to stand out, and they'll cover it up with that coat. And you won't see it the whole day. But most of them just wear a pullover. Well, somebody up in the ranks, a buyer got a good deal on some old cheap Italian ties. Buy racks and racks of these ties. A little display all set to go. And they come in, just take it out of the box and set one up by each register. They're pretty nice looking ties. They're in a dollar or so a piece. So.
You said $2 or so.
Well, $1, $2, they were cheap.
A tie.
Yes.
$6.
Very cheap. Some of them were pretty good looking, too. So what we did, we wouldn't wear a tie to work anymore. We'd come in and then go through the rack and pick the tie out that we wanted for the day. Tie it up. At the end of the day, usually you'd hang it back on the rack. But then some of the guys would just leave them around the store. Well, once the tie is all sold out of that rack, see, you could always walk around in different departments and look through the desk, and there'd be an old tie in there. Somebody had gotten a white one. And when they took it off the end of the day, it was left in the bottle room. And, of course, it just got filthy. And then someone would wear it, and they'd do some work and get it even dirtier. And then it got to the point where a lot of people just weren't wearing ties. And if someone came along and said, where's your tie? You got to have a tie on. They'd go back and get this white tie and put it on. And what I would do, I'd get a piece of cardboard, and I'd cut it out in the shape of a tie and decorate it with tape. Put that onto my shirt and wear that around. And, you know, they used to sell shoes in the store. This was before they got the ties. They had these old, cheap shoes. They had just a solid rubber bottom. There was no arch support. There was no nothing. It was just flat. But they were comfortable because it was all rubber on the bottom. And then a fuzzy leather top. And I think they were just $2. We got the big shipment of these in, and we all kind of giggled and put them up front because they looked like... Well, it's just kind of a farmer kind of shoe, you would think. Something you wear out in the field.
They weren't canvas tops?
No, they were leather. They had canvas inside, but the outside was a fuzzy leather. Well, first thing you know, one of the bag boys bought a pair. I put them on and wore them around the store. You were supposed to wear leather shoes and have them shining, preferably black. He's wearing these shoes around. And you couldn't say anything because all he had to say, well, Winn-Dixie sells them, why can't I wear them? And we all looked down at Alan's feet and kind of sticker, and then we all realized what he was doing. So all of us bought shoes, and we'd wear these shoes around all day. And they were about the most comfortable shoes I have had, because I used to wear a bag of produce department and have to stand in one spot all day. And I was always trying to take the dividers out of the apples that were kind of spongy and stand on those to soften it up. Well, these shoes, I didn't need them. They're big, wide shoes.
Mm-hmm. Now, what was that used to do?
Well, the apples, see, have plastic or paper dividers between them. I would take and put those on the floor and stand on them because I get tired just standing on one spot all day. But with these shoes, since they're rubber, I didn't get tired anymore. And it occurs to me that just while ago.
And you could tell the difference.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. If you didn't have good shoes, you couldn't work. They'd catch you in a few hours.
Really?
Yeah. And nothing would make me any more tired than bad shoes.
I didn't think that would bother anybody before they got to be 50, anyhow.
My father would, he would discard shoes that looked fine. He'd say, the arch is gone, I can't wear them anymore, because he's on his feet all day. And a good friend of his would do the same thing. This man worked on concrete. He's a maintenance foreman for the airline. And he must have had 10 or 15 pairs of shoes in his closet that were just looked in fine shape. He'd say, the arch is shot, and I can't wear them. And he'd buy a new pair. But these old rubber shoes didn't have an arch support in them. Nothing. Just as comfortable as I could be.
Yeah.
Some of the guys used to wear tennis shoes to work. Once they came out with the fancy tennis shoes, you'd get by with it. Because they looked pretty good. They all smell like high tops. They didn't appreciate too much. They were nice, tennis shoes.
Yeah.
And then they started selling shirts and handkerchiefs. And for a dollar or two, you'd get a pretty good shirt, considering the price, and you'd see bad boys wearing the shirt.
Now, what did we say last night? they just broke things for the hell of it. What was that we were saying?
Yeah, the way the store just supplied itself. See, we always use magic markers. When we had dented cans, we'd mark them half price. So what we'd do is take a magic marker and cross out the stamp price and write on the half price. Well, magic markers never stayed around the store. You could put one in the office and 10 minutes later be gone. And no one had ever put them back. So when you needed one, you just went on the shelf and took it.
Yeah.
I asked the store manager. I said, Henry, I need a magic marker to stay off the shelf. And I asked him, well, what about the cost? He said, oh, don't worry about it. We're going store supply. So I guess they just wrote up all this. I just kind of guessed at how much it was. Well, we never had any black or blue magic markers on the shelf, because we took them all. We took all the scotch tape we needed. We took all the pencils we needed.
But it was the truck drivers that get ran by.
Oh, man, the truck drivers would destroy the hell out of their truck. They, Winn-Dixie bought the cheapest trucks they could buy. They'd buy them without tires and buy tires wholesale and put them on if they'd get them cheaper.
Oh, really?
Yeah. You know, you'd look in at the dashboard and there'd be all the blank spots because they wouldn't buy any of the gauges.
Oh, don't tell me.
No, they'd put their own gauges in. No, I can spot a Winn-Dixie truck anytime. It's an old beat up green truck coming down the highway. I can just look and just see something. I go, that's a Winn-Dixie truck, and it'll be a Winn-Dixie truck. The drivers had no respect for these trucks. They'd get brand new trailers. Trailers ran about, I think they cost as much as $10,000 or $15,000 a piece for just the trailer.
Yeah.
I remember we get a new trailer in, it'd be just as shiny and smooth. Inside everything'd be nice and clean. And the doors would just swing open as smooth as they could be and close back up and the latch would just drop in place. You wouldn't have to fight it. Maybe one run it'd be like that. Next time he'd come into the loading bay, he'd rev up the engine and just roar back. And then try and hit the brakes and stop before it got to the door. Well, it never did. Bam! It hit that door, and it catched the hinges of the door, and Bo, the door is out. So when he came to the store, I walk up to hit the latch, and I couldn't move it. So we'd have to cut the seals off, and they get a bar, use the bar of the door, and beat the latch off. And when you did, the doors would just pop open. Come time to close it, we'd have two or three people come out and push on the doors, and then I'd put my hands on the latch, and somebody else would put their hands on my hands, and somebody else would beat down on our hands to get the latch shut. They have finally gotten to where they take off these swinging doors and put sliding doors in. See, only thing that happens there is that they'll load these trailers up, The last thing they get to say canned drinks, like in these cases of Coca-Cola and stuff. They'll put those right at the end. Well, when the driver takes off, of course, he floors it and goes fast as he can. He hits the brakes, he hits them hard, and the tailor shakes. All these drinks fall up against the door. The truck comes in, and somebody say, well, you got 400 cases of drinks then. And you look at the trailer, and you notice the rear end sitting way down. So you figure, they probably put the drinks on last. And we undo the latch and start to slide the door, and it won't move. So we'll work it up enough so we can pry it open. And then we stick a bar in there and start working it up, and all of a sudden, cans start coming out. And they'll run out like water. And a little more, you open the door, and they just keep running out all over the ground. Just dense the hell out of the cans. They break open, they'll spray Coca-Cola all over everybody, and we just don't care. So if you're going to put it there at the end where we can't get the door open, that's fine. We'll tear the drinks up. We get that door all the way up, and here they come. Whoosh, 400 cases. They had a driver come in along the store. He had to pull up beside the store parallel to park and unload out the side door. Well, he came in too close to the building. He got the trailer wedged. I think he had it wedged between a fire hydrant and the wall. He was trying to pull out of there. And it got stuck to the point that the truck couldn't pull it. And they had to unhook it and get a wrecker to pull it out. And when they finally got the trailer off the wall, when it cleared the building, it hopped over about a foot. It had been pressing against the wall. And just took the whole side of the trailer and cut it open. Brand new trailer.
Well, now, that's what happens down here. Old Fred. That's what the used car lot. I mean, junk car lot. Right next to him is this well digger. With him. Father and son. And I saw a truck together. Noticed another one or two there, and I said, you work on his truck? Well, he says, I worked on them. Hold on. Put a new transmission in it. Well, somehow we've been talking about roughnecks. And that was what it went into. Those drivers just go on until they get bored, and then they'll just tear it and tear it up. They'll just race it, or what do they do, Rick? And you see, it's a truck, and it's loaded, and they'll speed it and stop it.
And let that clutch out too fast.
And they'll burn it out. They do it on purpose. And he told once Fred, old Fred, now he doesn't stutter, but he has a defect, and it's hard for me to understand it. But I could understand everything he said about that. And he told some stories. It's the same sort of thing that happened up there in Georgia. He says, at those sawmills, he says, if the boss man said they were going to work on Saturday morning, one of them would run the saw into a log and bust it into pieces. Not bust it into pieces, but bust it up. So it'd take them a couple of days to get the saw fixed, and they wouldn't have to work on a Saturday morning. Now, that's not a reason. That's no reason.
When I worked for a newspaper, we used to buy these.
Good Lord. You worked for a newspaper.
Buy these big rolls of paper that were about as tall as I am and this wide. And if we needed them, because the people who had the paper were just kind of, we'll bring it by one of these times. And if we need the paper, we need the paper. We call them up and they say, we're supposed to bring this Wednesday and today's Friday and we need the paper this afternoon. And if they had to make an extra run that they were, should not have to make had they been on time. And they had to come out all the way on Friday afternoon. That would get them back late Friday night. They'd bring the paper, and they'd come to the door of the office, and the office was there, and the printing presses and all there. They'd say, the paper's here, and this is.